And welcome back to the Constitutionals Podcast. I'm your host, Chad White. If you didn't know, this is the premier podcast for the website, cplushcomedy.com. Like I just said, it's a website. Go there. Welcome back, 288. I'm petting the dog. You'll see him off camera, standing here, wearing his shock collar inside because he pissed me off. And I have to teach him some manners. Yesterday, I'm recording this several days late. Who cares? Not that many people listen to this show. At this point, this is just a notch in the belt for the portfolio. But yesterday, I wake up, I take him out, go downstairs, take him to the dog park. No one's down there. I take him to the dog park that's inside of my apartment complex. And for a second, for a split second, when I'm putting on his collar and everything, I go, I should put on the shock collar. I should e-collar. Call e-collars now. They vibrate, they beep, they also shock. I went, I should put on the e-collar. I went, nah, he's going to be good today. This man has the most energy in the world. He's running around, eating up. There's a central part where there's turf, and then there's an outer part where there's kind of, it's not wooded, it's just lots of trees, and dogs go back there and people don't pick up their dog poop. Meanwhile, I'm the bad guy because my dog wants to play with everyone's dogs, and their golden retrievers or their doodles or their labs are so prissy and they don't want to play, and I get treated like the pariah, which is why I have to take him down to the dog park at 7 o'clock in the morning. Anyway, he's eating poop back there and he's not listening to me, and I was thinking, God, if I had the e-collar, I could vibrate, then he doesn't listen to me, I could put on level 3 shock, then he doesn't listen to me, put on level 5. But he'd listen to me at level 5. It wouldn't be going higher than that. It goes 99. He's only gone to 7. Anyway, that's what I've been dealing with. And also, I just woke up. I was like, I'm bored. I've been bored lately. Oh, let's do this. This is meant to be an intro for somebody I talked to. I talked to Ryan Hansen. Actor extraordinaire Ryan Hansen. You may remember him from such... Spelled his name wrong. Well, we changed that in the title. You may remember him from such shows as Veronica Mars. And what else would he be known for? Let's see. I'm going through his IMDb. He was on a show called Ryan Hansen Solves Crimes on Television. I believe that was a YouTube show. Don't quote me on that, because I don't remember if it was or not. It was a YouTube Red show, and I did watch that show. Correct. Let's see. You've seen him in everything. You've seen him in a lot of stuff. I'll say one more thing. He was also on the Mindy Project. There you go. Anyway, Ryan Hansen, he's a very funny guy. And there will not be any video for this for reasons that I do not want to get into. Why is that a thumbs down? Why did that happen? Anyway, so you'll be getting the exclusive audio interview for this. It's no one's fault. It's just timing did not work out for a video. He's in a car and the video is vertical. And I just don't feel comfortable putting something like that out. So there you go. Because I think we talk about that in the show, in the interview. Anyway, he appeared on, but you know, I'm very happy I got to talk to him. He appeared on the second season of Night Court Reboot. And he's a new love interest for Abby in the show. So there you go. If you're wondering what happened to Pete Holmes, you missed the entire second half of this season, or first half of this well season. So, anyway, I like Ryan Hansen. He's a very nice guy, very funny, and I enjoyed his stint on that show as well as everything he's done. I like Ryan Hansen. I'm a Ryan Hanshead. We're gonna go with that. Check it out. Here's the interview with Ryan Hansen, Night Court Season 2. It's all on Peacock. And we'll be getting back to the regular episode after the break.
You're good
Did
to
you
go.
paint that, Chad? There's no way. That tiger.
Oh no. I found it in the antique store. 65
Dude,
bucks.
it's so cool. No way. That thing's sick.
Yeah, I had to talk them down from 70.
Oh, you did it.
How's it going? How's everything with you, Ryan?
Good man, just hanging. Sorry, I'm in the car, but here we are.
No worries. As long as you're not driving, we'll be safe.
Okay. I'm not driving. That's
Oh
my
no.
wife.
Well, Ryan,
He's just hot.
congratulations on this role. I know it's not it's recurring, it's guest star, all that stuff, but I still think it's great to see someone I know, not that I know personally, but that I know is in a role with a show that I enjoy.
Yeah, thanks, dude. It's so cool to I was pumped to do the first episode. They asked me back. I was like, absolutely. It's the most fun cast. The live audience stuff is just a blast. You know, there's not that many of them anymore. So to be able to do it is I jumped at the opportunity for sure. Yeah.
How is it hearing laughs like almost immediately as soon as you tell a joke, as opposed to doing something that's single camera and then having to wait and see if that what you did really delivered?
Yeah, it's really a unique experience because you get immediate feedback, you know, from the audience. If they're not laughing at that thing or that joke the way you said it, or maybe it's what you said, they'll just give you an alt. They'll give you a new line. They'll rewrite the scene, you know, right there. And it's really cool. And then you do the alt and everyone laughs, you know, it's like, oh, that's crazy. That really works. So it's cool to have a live audience, in that aspect for sure. Yeah.
Did you take anything away from John and Melissa as you had a chance to work with them? What was it like being with such two big legendary comedy actors in their own rights?
Yeah, I mean, I was nervous jumping in, you know, because they're in their second season. Everyone's got their vibe going. They're in their own little bubble. And, you know, some shows I've jumped on, it's a little harder to break through. They were all so cool and welcoming. Melissa is like, she made it feel like home. I mean, she really was like, she's so incredibly inclusive and funny and like just makes you feel so comfortable that I got to do my best because she was so cool and made me feel so great about what I was doing and all that stuff. And John, same thing. He's just a legend. And to be able to watch him work, you know, and when he turns it on, it's just incredible. It's so cool. So I really got to learn from watching both of them and getting to work with them. Yeah, it's
How was
amazing.
it? So a Night Court sequel series, did you ever watch the original show? Because I like my journey with it was I worked at a TV network here in Atlanta that was airing the second rights to it, and so I got a chance to watch everything in broken order, but I saw pretty much every episode in a reasonable amount of time, like 2 months, and it was fantastic. And that was like 2 or 3 years ago. How was this your first journey with Night Court, or did you have a chance to watch it when it was on?
Well, growing up, I wasn't allowed to watch it because I grew up in a conservative household. My parents, I think they watched it. They loved it. So yeah, I caught it later, like Nick at Night style. You know, I'd watch a few episodes here and there. I definitely haven't watched all of it, but Millie's calling. Okay. So I huge fan. You know, later when it was re-airing. And then to be able to jump on and do like, I guess is it a reboot? What is it? What is it called? Anyway.
A reboot sequel series, yeah,
Yeah,
mostly
yeah.
that.
It's so cool because like you're like, I was just it's like all of the same sets and all that stuff. It's very surreal to jump in there and be like, but now I'm on this show that I remember not being able to watch when I was a kid. It's cool. It's very, very cool. Yeah.
What did you want to bring anything to the show? I know that obviously you can't do much as somebody who was just appearing on it, but did you want to bring something to the show, to the character in your own aspect, and kind of just leave your mark?
Yeah, I mean, no, nothing crazy, nothing. I mean, you know, like I wanted to. Well, really, the goal is to be invited back. You know what I mean? So I just wanted to do a good job and do what they kind of like saw for this character, and I just kind of bring my own flavor to it. And it seems like they liked it. I get to come back. You know, I got to come back, and I'm dating Melissa's character. You know, but we're keeping it casual. So you know, just to do a good job and to be proud of myself and to feel like I did good is my goal, you know. Nothing more. I mean, nothing. I can't really, You know, because in multicam stuff, there's not really room for improv or anything like that. It's pretty much set up joke. Like, it's very, you'll kind of ruin the flow of it if you kind of add your own shtick, you know. So I just wanted to do a good job, and I think I did all right.
Yeah, I think so as well. For this role, I again, like you said, there's not a lot of wiggle room for things, but I know this isn't your first multicam role. And what was it like to step back into this show, knowing that there wasn't as much weight on your shoulders as there were for other ones where you were the main person who had to take on that leadership type deal?
Yeah, it's cool. It's you get to relax a little more, like have a little more fun with it. Like you said, the pressure is not really there. It's not your show. But you don't want to be the guy that's like, oh, that episode is great, but that one guy, you know, so you don't want to do that. It's cool being able to kind of see everyone, especially they're in their second season and they got their vibe going, and to see how everyone works and to kind of just kind of jump in like double Dutch style and see if you can keep up. You know, it's pretty fun. Yeah.
Yeah. What about the schedule? I know the schedule is very tight for multicams. Did that work for you? Do you enjoy like having something that is just so regimented as opposed to doing something that's single camera where you have to shoot at night, you have to shoot over here, to shoot over there? Did that really help you out in your acting style?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, on a single camera, you could be on any location, however far away, you know. With this, it's at Warner Brothers, it's down the street. Most of the days I can still pick up my kids from school. The schedule for multicam is incredible, especially if you got a little family or whatever. So I was happy to do it. And it's just kind of a bummer there's not as many multicams anymore. But the ones that are good, like this one, it's just incredible to be a part of. And the schedule is, it's killer. It's the best.
What were you doing in between your scenes? Were you picking over at Crafty? What's your favorite Crafty snack? What are you getting over there?
I'll tell you right now, and I can do it at home, and I don't know why I don't do it, but you slice the apples like long ways, and they're kind of not too thin, and then the peanut butter and then granola, and you make a sandwich. And so it's like an apple, peanut butter, granola sandwich, and they have them at Crafty all the time, and they are my favorite. I love them so much. And then when I'm not at Crafty, which is where I'm usually, I'll either watch the scenes that I'm not in and laugh along with the crew. Or I'll be playing my Switch. I'll be playing Zelda, baby. Tears of the Kingdom. Even though I beat it, I still play it. I love it.
I was actually playing it last night, and I am so far behind. It's great though. I got it for my birthday from my sister, so I have to hop back into it. I just like to take my time because
me too.
We're gonna get another big Zelda game like this where I can go to three different levels of the Earth.
Oh, it's so cool. I know it'll be another 5 years till we get one, but it's the coolest game. Take your time. Yeah. Absolutely.
And you know, Ryan, I got one more for you.
Okay.
You've been doing comedy, you've been doing dramedies, and again, this is a multicam. How are you as an actor who is taking care of their lines, looking at the pages that they get, and even though again this is recurring, guest star, all that stuff, how do you approach your acting style with your remembering the lines and doing the lines and performing the jokes in ways that you see fit and the ways that the writers and directors and producers work with them too?
So I really like to go over my stuff at least the night before, like, and really kind of get it down, you know, like all that stuff, and be really prepared on set and then be able to play with it. That, you know, once you know it really well, then you can kind of play with it. That's what I like. So to do multicam, it's very interesting. It changes every night, and the pages will come in sometimes at like 1 a.m. or like the next morning. So it really took a lot for me. It takes a lot for me when I do a multicam or a show like this to kind of let it go and to know that I'm not going to know my lines the day before. It's going to be fine. And to just kind of trust myself and trust my instincts about getting them that morning and knowing that everyone else is in the same boat, you know, like not like somebody else is getting the lines before or whatever. Everyone's kind of getting the fresh lines that day. And then just being, and so that creates like a looseness, which I'm not really used to, but it's great. So to kind of like on the fly, learn your lines and here we go. I don't know if that made any sense, Chad.
Yeah, I did. That's perfect. That you gave
Okay.
me a great answer, and in fact, I'm going to use it as a pull quote for this interview.
Hey.
Ryan, thank you so much. I appreciate it. This is fantastic. I think you're a very funny guy, and you do an awesome job whatever you're in. So this is a dream come true.
Thanks, buddy. You're so cool. And congrats on that tiger saving $5.
All
You rule.
right,
All
man. Have a good day.
right. See you, buddy.
Thanks, bye. And we're back. Welcome back to the Constitutionals podcast. All right. We've got enough squabbling about. I know that means fighting. Let's get on with the episode. This comes from Variety, written by Todd Spangler. YouTube's Dude Perfect scores $100 million plus investment as it plans new Texas HQ as family-friendly entertainment destination. These guys are quickly trying to create, not quickly. They're trying to create their own Disneyland, their own Universal in the heart of Texas. And you know what? More power to them. Dude Perfect, if you don't know, they're YouTubers who are from, I would say, the early day, the mid-early days of YouTube, where they were creating trick shots, riding down a hill on a sled in the middle of summer heat, and there's a basketball goal at the end of the hill, and they're launching a basketball or a football or whatever, 70 yards, and it hits the backboard and it goes in, or it swishes, and it's I mean it swishes the net, and I mean it's amazing. I think they are very nice guys, and they're just well-meaning. It is also very funny to like watch their video sometime, and then like they play music in the background of these videos, and they are religious guys. They're religious guys, and sometimes you'll see a video, and then like you'll hear the music. It's like, "And work with him in the name of the Lord." It's just like very funny to hear like this rock music that's like Christian tone. Anyway, they are bringing in, as I mentioned, $100 million in growth capital from private investment firm Highmount Capital, which is what they're going to use to help build their giant production facility slash entertainment park over there in Frisco, Texas. This was announced more than a year ago, and they're describing it as a combination production facility and family-friendly entertainment destination comprising a retail store and new spaces for podcasts and gaming. So it seems like it's going to be like, a Paramount studio or a Disney studio, but you're also going to be able to go there, take tours, and see stuff, and do a 330-foot trick shot tower. See a Dude Perfect museum, a mini golf course, and some restaurants. They're going to do an international tour. They've got a streaming app coming up, and they've got a 30 for 30 documentary that's going to premiere April 25th at the Dallas International Film Festival. And I do that makes sense that they have a 30 for 30 documentary. I love 30 for 30. I think it's such a smart idea that they went past the original 30. I like it. They've been posting their trick shot videos since 2009. I was correct. I said mid-early YouTube, because early YouTube is 2005. Generated more than 17 point. I was gonna say generated. They generated more than 17 point 17 billion views, and garnered more than 60 million subs. The Dude Perfect team also has a faith-based mission. Quote: "We're giving back. We're about giving back, spreading joy, and glorifying Jesus." That their website says. This is a no-brainer for them. They're one of. I can't name any other YouTube channel that is as successful in the same way. I would probably say someone along the lines of Doug DeMiro, because he's able to start Cars and Bids, which is a car auctioning site that you can sell your car on, or you can buy a car from. But I can't think of any other YouTube channels. Oh, Mr. Beast, obviously, that do the same, or able to generate the same kind of, not in the same scale necessarily, but that kind of wealth. And then also turn it into a successful business on the outside. Who has Prime? Jake Paul. I don't like that guy, but Prime kind of to me, it blew up because I didn't know about it until January of this year when I saw it on store shelves at Target. I'm thinking, what's Prime? And then I see Prime on this, like literally just bottles on the street, just empty bottles, you know, after festivals or something. And I'm thinking, wow, people just really love this stuff. And then I think South Park did, and their latest special on Paramount Plus, they had some Prime things in there. So, yeah. Anyway, but this makes sense. Dude Perfect has been truly all over the place. I mean, they've had a Nickelodeon show. They have apps, and they've got a great name, Dude Perfect. What else have they had? Let's see. The group was selected by the Harlem Globetrotters to play in their annual player draft in 2015. They had a CMT show as well. The Dude Perfect show is that one show. Okay, never mind. I thought they had more. They had a documentary on YouTube Originals. They released a song. And they have all the world records in the world. So, there you go. Thumbs up. Next up, CBS News goes 24/7. This comes from Variety, written by Brian Steinberg. My fridge just turned on. CBS News plans streaming overhaul with new Whip Around program. CBS News is well, that's a dryer. I was like, what was all this noise going on? CBS News is this amalgamous term or title for all of the CBS broadcasters' coverage of news events. Same thing like NBC News, ABC News. They all have their own coverage. I was going to mention Fox, and I was like, wait, Fox News is a thing. Fox Broadcasting doesn't have a news channel. It's Fox News. Anyway, and for these past couple of years, CBS News has had, I really did not pay attention prior to the streaming revolution, but CBS News and NBC News and ABC News have streaming channels that you can find for CBS News on Pluto, on YouTube, wherever, 24/7 streaming channels. That and then for NBC, same thing on Peacock, whatever, and ABC, I don't know where you find that. But they more or less, they play the same stories that are on their parent programs. So if something happened on NBC Nightly News, if a story was airing on there, then, you know, in a couple of hours, you're probably going to see it on NBC News's Peacock NBC News channel or wherever they have this channel. You can probably find it on the NBC News app or whatever. Roku. Just one word, Roku. But because we're in the streaming world where, you know, CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, yes, they can be, they have been 24 hours for the past couple of years, but they're stuck on these cable platforms. And you see CNN at Warner trying to break out of that by including CNN Max on HBO Max. I'm going to keep calling it that. They tried that before with the CNN live app. I don't know. I forgot what it was. CNN Plus app. And obviously that didn't work, but then they smartly released it on Max, which is where it should have been the entire time. And then you see Peacock, you know, invest in having NBC News have its own big kind of explosion for Peacock, wherein that you can watch, if you subscribe to the highest tier of Peacock, you can watch the Today Show live on Peacock. You can watch exclusives of NBC News stuff live there. And also, I don't know if they still do this, but they did have some shows, NBC News shows that were made specifically for Peacock. And this is before the big turn into TikTok and everything. I don't know if they still do those shows, but anyway. So now you have Paramount, who was in the middle of being bought by maybe Skydance, go in on CBS News. And they kind of had to at this point because not many places have a news channel, and you either double down or you start letting people go. and they have this, they have CBS News, they have mornings, they have CBS mornings, they have the CBS nightly news program, which is not what it's called, CBS evenings, I guess. I don't know. So they kind, they need to focus on this because this is one of their tent poles for television, CBS News, CBS Broadcasting, and then the primetime stuff, which I'm including late night in, which is technically not primetime, but whatever. So now CBS News is being renamed and is being overhauled. They've got CBS News 24/7. It's going to rely on journalists from both the national news outlet as well as from local CBS stations and serve as the new name of the broadband outlet. John Dickerson is going to get more help. There are going to be more shows, and he's going to, John Dickerson is the lead anchor, and he's going to be able to help kind of lead that section of CBS News. They have a CBS News Washington Bureau, and it's going to launch a 1 a.m. program called CBS News Roundup for late night viewing. I don't know who that's for. The move represents some of the most significant from the president and CEO of a unit that compromises CBS News local station syndication, Wendy McMahon. She was given sole oversight of CBS News, the company stations, and its syndication business in August of last year. And this is just, this is the first big step that she's taken since then. She is one of a group of business executives who have been handed the reins of news operations at traditional media companies, which are testing new strategies for reliable newscasts in an era when viewers are dispersing to a panoply of new streaming options. So why are they doing this? They want to be able to, especially with that 1 a.m. show, touch on a new audience. A lot of this is going to be geared towards people who are, well, I mean, we're all on our phones, but it's going to be geared towards people who rely on watching news broadcasts and how they get their news. So you're going to see it on TikTok, you're going to see it on Instagram, you're going to see it on YouTube, I assume. You're going to see a big push on the Paramount Plus app. You're going to see, you're going to see a lot of streaming efforts really come from this. And you're going to see a lot of, what I'm guessing is because they have the local stuff too, you're going to see a lot of cross-pollination. So maybe you'll see some, I mean, we see this all the time. You're going to see some CBS Sunday morning, CBS News Sunday morning show, story be teased on the Thursday episode of CBS Mornings. You're going to see the nightly show, you're going to see that be teased on a Sunday show. You're going to see stories pop up everywhere and be played and replayed. And this is pivotal because we are in the middle of an election year. And people are going to start choosing not only sides for who are they going to vote for, but they're going to start choosing right now where they're going to get their news from. And if CBS can be one of those hours, or one of those platforms for you, then they're going to take it. Executives see the new whip-around format, which takes viewers to whatever seems most pressing or important as the backbone of the service. The concept has already proven popular in sports, where the NFL Red Zone cable network takes subscribers from one interesting play to the next across the league on any given in-season Sunday. NBC recently unveiled plans to use a whip-around concept as the backbone of its Olympic coverage and its Peacock streaming hub, and a new Gold Zone program hosted in part by Red Zone anchor Scott Hansen. So basically, you're going to, if there are six stories happening in a day, like today is, again, this is late. Today is the start of the jury selection for Trump's civil trial in New York. So you're going to have, if even a little monochrome of news happens there, like, oh, if they've chosen the first juror, then you're going to see, that's going to be the lead story. And then if there's another earthquake in New York, you're going to see that. They're going to hop over that. Whip around is just a fancy term for they're going to be going back and forth between different types of stories. They're going to introduce new shows like America Decides, a weekday look at Washington news and politics. That's going to launch April 22nd. You're going to see an expansion of John Dickerson's primetime newscast that's going to go to 90 minutes from an hour. Huh. I don't know if we need that. And that's going to be renamed to The Daily Report with John Dickerson. I like it. I mean, the more sources for news we have out there, especially on television, it's very important. And it seems like it's a dying medium, but this is, it's the same reason why SNL or Key and Peele or any other sketch series that's on television, they don't just make things for online. They don't make it for YouTube. They broadcast it because there's money in that. And there's also a chance to have more eyes and it can spread and go viral and things like that. They need them at CBS News and NBC News to an extension and ABC News. Focusing in on television instead of just trying to lean in on TikTok is great because there's still people who watch television. They can reach a streaming audience and they can also have the online. They can do all that stuff in one. It's fantastic. All right. Next up, NPR is accused of bias by one of its journalists, and not one single person is happy by this journalist. This comes from the New York Times, written by Benjamin Mullen and Katie Robinson. Yuri Berliner, who's a senior business editor who worked at NPR for 25 years, wrote an essay that was published by the Free Press last week, which is part of a Substack publication, and wrote that, quote, "People at every level of NPR have comfortably coalesced around the progressive worldview." And okay, I'm not going to say don't read this. Check out his piece. It's very center-right, and he's essentially saying that NPR has chosen a side when they're supposed to be objective, and it is and that they're going downhill and spiraling downhill. And he's also said the internal culture at NPR had placed race and identity as, quote, paramount in nearly every aspect of the workplace. I mean, dude, you sound like a relic of your own time. And it is unfortunate that you think that way, that you think that NPR has become this left-leaning bastion for people who are just who hate, you know, Republicans, which is not the case. I mean, every podcast I listen to from NPR, every story I read is in such a middle of the lane gray area that I think that people that I once thought were left or right, or that I once thought were right or left, and vice versa. The essay ignited a firestorm of criticism of NPR and social media, especially among conservatives who have long accused the network of political bias for its reporting. NPR has forcibly pushed back on Berliner's accusations and criticism, and people that work at NPR are very angry that he's still working there for some reason. Some other NPR journalists also criticized the essay publicly, including Eric Deggans, its TV critic, who faulted Berliner for not giving NPR an opportunity to comment on the piece. In an interview on Thursday, Berliner expressed no regrets about publishing the essay, saying he loved NPR and hoped to make it better by airing criticisms that have gone unheeded by leaders for years. He called NPR a, quote, national trust that people rely on for fair reporting and superb storytelling. When you write a piece that is very accusatory like that, and you don't reach out to the company for comment, you were at fault for basically falling into the same accusations that you're putting out there. It doesn't make any sense when you are having a one-sided argument or conversation and you're not giving them to a chance to speak up, or like having a dialogue in a space where you really need it. Because right now you're just pointing fingers. You know what happens when you point one finger? Four pointing back at you. Three pointing back at you. Whose thumb is pointing back like this? When the hosts of NPR's Biggest Shows convened on Wednesday afternoon for a long scheduled meet and greet with the network's new chief executive, Catherine Maher. Conversations, it's M-A-H-E-R. My baloney has a first name, it's M-A-H-E-R. Conversations soon turned to Mr. Berliner's essay, according to two people with knowledge of the meeting. During lunch, Ms. Chapin, who is the who works at NPR in some way? Hold on, let me see. Who is the organization's editor in chief? Told the host that she didn't want Mr. Berliner to become, quote, a martyr, the people said. Okay. Anyway, I mean, it's the same thing that happens when somebody says CNN leans left or something along those lines. It's, you know, I heard a political person last week, or a talking head, whatever, talk about how, let me go along with CNN. How they said that CNN had put on a jersey and they'd chosen a side, and that was leaning left, and in this world of we're again like doing a story against Trump means that you're against Republicans as a whole, which is not the case. There's things that you talk about in the political parties that are you know, it's like, oh, the left wants abortion and women's rights, and then the right doesn't want abortion, they don't want women's rights. Those are things you go back and forth about. But then when it comes to something like Trump, those views are so radical and so off-putting and wrong and hurtful to a lot of people that you say anything against it or for it, then you're the best person, you know, not I don't, whatever, but you get the point. And NPR, for what it's worth, has not chosen any type of jersey. They have not chosen a side. In the same case, I'm coming from CNN. I did not see any side choosing over there. They just did stories. They just did a lot of not anti-Trump stuff. They just cover a lot of Trump coverage. So in the same vein, just because they cover a lot of Trump things doesn't mean that they're necessarily anti-Trump. Because there's a lot of people that, not a lot, there's several people that their correspondents at CNN that worked with Trump. Alyssa Farah Griffin. They had Adam Kinzinger. They like just the Scaramouche. You know, all those people have worked with him. And they are, by all means, still conservatives. They're still Republicans. They're still getting paid to appear over there. They're just anti-Trump. Everybody's anti-Trump. And so that goes for NPR, just because they're doing anti-Trump stories or they're doing stories about race or gender or whatever. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily choosing a side. They're just reporting on what's important at the moment in time. That's why podcasts like Code Switch or the, what is the NPR Latino podcast? Alt Latino. You know, Radio Ambulante. That's why these shows exist, because they need coverage and they need representation. So this guy is only looking at NPR as a whole, and he's saying, oh, they're doing stories about sex and gender and race, and it's too much. Well, that's what needs to be covered. Anyway, there's a whole messy way of saying that this guy's wrong and stupid. All right, this final story comes from the New York Times, written by James Poniewozik. Why are people obsessed with TV finales, quote-unquote, sticking the landing? Curb Your Enthusiasm ended last week after, what, 20 years, 25 years, 24 years on air, and 12 years, 24 years, 24 seasons, 12 seasons, 24 years, And you know what? For what it's worth, we know Larry's never going to learn a lesson. We know that he's always going to say something insane, or not insane. He's going to say something that is on our minds, but we agree with, and he's going to be that vocal piece. That character is going to be that vocal piece. And the show ended with he and his friends on a plane all arguing with each other about a very mundane thing, like Susie opening the shade on a plane so she can get some light to read a book. Anyway, the finale of the show, I'm going to go ahead and ruin it. It's been a week. If you wanted to see it, you would have seen it by now. The finale of the show ended, and it was very much foreshadowing this from episode one, that Larry was going to go to jail because of something he did in Georgia in regards to a voting law where he gave a friend a bottle of water. You're not allowed to do that. It's a real law. And he gets in trouble. He gets arrested. And all season long, he's got to deal with this. And then it quickly, people put together, you know, in episode one, oh, he's going to go to jail, and it's going to mirror the Seinfeld finale, the infamous Seinfeld finale, where all four characters went to jail, and and that's how the show ended. So in the finale, they do this courtroom scenes, these courtroom scenes rather, and some characters come back. They don't have everybody come back. It'd have been great if they like. It's strange how they chose like three characters, and like two from this season. But anyway, some characters came back, and then he ends up going to jail. And the episode with 4 minutes left is like they're dollying backwards, and Larry and it references back to the first episode talking about Pants Tent, and then out of the blue, Seinfeld comes up and is like, "Hey, you're getting out of jail because of this stupid thing." And then they turn to each other, he and Larry turn to each other and go, "We should have done this for the Seinfeld finale," which yes, it's poking fun at that thing that people hate. But also, for this show to end on a plane with Larry arguing with the main character of the show and Ted Danson, I don't know why Ted Danson was there, but for Larry to, I know why he was there, but he's not really a main character. But for them to be arguing with each other, That is the ending. Like, that is the end of the show. And the same goes for other shows like Cheers, you're speaking of dancing, or MASH. Just because they had great, excellent finales doesn't mean that every show has to have the same tie it up in a bow finale. Like, look at Cheers. Cheers ended with, Ted. I'm genuinely forgetting the names. Ted running away and leaving the bar, and going with Shelley Long because they're going to try love again, and they're sitting on the plane. They go, "This isn't going to work out." And then he returns to the bar and he has his last conversation with Norm, and he turns off the lights, and you know, the next day they're all going to come back and do, you know, another day at Cheers. What else? Friends ended with everybody going their separate ways, more or less. You know, Chandler and Monica move away, move out of the apartment, and Rachel and Ross are going to try again, and Joey's, you know, the spinoff counts. Joey moves to California, and Phoebe has Paul Rudd, Mike, I think that's his name. So not everything has to have these giant, you know, neatly packed endings. People don't like the ending of The Office. People don't like the ending of Lost. But it all happens. You know, this is what they came up with at the perfect time for themselves. And I know I've not referenced Mr. Poniewozik's piece, but this is more or less capturing what's going on, what he's writing about. The Mad Men finale was great. He writes about that. How About Your Mother? I think How About Your Mother had a fine finale. A fine final season. He writes, "When serial stories end badly, however, it's usually the result of wrong turns taken much earlier that no immaculate kicker can redeem, as with the forced push toward a predetermined conclusion that ruined the last season or so of How About Your Mother, ditto for reasons, for different reasons, Game of Thrones." I think they're fine. If anything, Game of Thrones is more rushed than How I Met Your Mother. Also, How I Met Your Mother, the entire last season takes place over 3 days. Come on. I think that's really fun. He writes, my bigger problem with sticking the landing is what it implies about what matters in art. That an artist's highest concern should be not to make a mistake. That narrative art is a story problem that builds toward a correct solution. That the ending of a work determines its final score. That there is a score, and that the score is calculated through a running tally of credits and deductions. That it is linear, that is math. See also the sportsmanlike obsession with some fans with Rotten Tomato percentages. I mean, that's very true. Sometimes endings stink, like the Dexter finale, which I know people hated. But you're not taking it as a whole. You're not seeing the enjoyment that the entire story was telling you. Go back to How I Met Your Mother. We spent 9 seasons with these characters, and yes, there were ups and downs. There was Barney dating Robin, which I just hate intergroup dating. There's Ted dating Quinn. Is that her name? Oh my God. Hold on. How I Met Your Mother, Quinn. Is that her name? Yeah. Quinn sucked. Ugh. No, wait. Quinn was, No. Hold on. That's not the one I'm talking about. Who is the one Ted, dates, the activist. Oh, God. I can't remember her name. That's how much I hate her. Zoe. Oh, Zoe sucked. Zoe stunk. Quinn was great. Quinn was the one that Barney should have married. It should have been Quinn or Nora. Anyway. I mean, yes. There are parts we hate, but it's the ending is not the totality of everything. And regardless of how a show ends, you're going to remember it not for the ending. You're going to remember it for the time you spent with it. All right, listen. If you like what you heard here, head to the website cbluscomedy.com where you've got me interviewing some people. Ryan Hansen, of course, I just talked to. India de Beaufort, LaCretta, and Nyambi Nyambi for Night Court as well. I also talked to Jesse David Fox and Eddie Schmidt for The Good One, which is the Mike Birbiglia Peacock documentary. So check out all of those, cpluscomedy.com. You can watch video versions of two of those interviews on youtube.com/cpluscomedy. You can see a video version of this podcast there as well. You can also subscribe, see video versions of other podcasts, including the Constitutionals podcast, and which is the Entertainment Business News podcast. Oh, wait, this is that. Late Night Lately, which is the Late Late Night Show, and LinkedIn Logs, which is the Jobs podcast. You can follow us on TikTok, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at C Plus Comedy. Follow me at Chad Black White. Subscribe to those other shows wherever you get your podcasts. And that is it. I thought the spiel would cover the rest of this intro part. But it's not. Okay. I'll see you later. Bye.